Our civil liberties, are they in danger? This is one of the vital issues facing America today. To discuss the ways in which all can contribute to the solution of this and other basic problems, the National Broadcasting Company, each week at this time, makes its facilities available to representatives of labor, management, and agriculture. This is in the American tradition. This is America United. As one of the cooperating organizations presenting America United, the Congress of Industrial Organizations today is host for this discussion on our civil liberties. Are they in danger? Kennedy Ludlam, NBC announcer, will act as moderator. Mr. Ludlam.
Thank you, Mr. Batchelor. How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? 6 years ago today, the United States was drawn into a war against fascist dictatorship. We won that conflict for liberty and freedom, but even now, the problem of our basic daily civil rights as Americans looms large in our thinking. More than at any time in recent years, Americans are asking, our civil rights, are they in danger? And if they are, who is endangering them? And again, if our civil rights are in danger, what steps should we take to strengthen and protect them? These are questions up for discussion on our America United roundtable today. Obviously, in our brief half hour, we can only hit the high spots of problems. Now, let's see what they have to say on this vitally important problem. With us today are Ms. Leslie Perry of the Legislative Staff of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, Mr. Palmer Weber, Research Director of the CIO Political Action Committee, Mr. Fred Bailey of the National Grange, and Mr. Frank Donner of the Legal Staff of the Congress of Industrial Organizations. Well, here's the question, gentlemen. Are our civil rights in danger? Mr. Perry?
Yes, our civil liberties are threatened on every front.
Well, Mr. Weber, how do you feel?
I think that the constant practice of name-calling is endangering our basic liberties today.
Mr. Bailey?
A democracy must be constantly on the alert, of course, to protect our civil liberties. We must protect those liberties of the persons, people, but we must not forget that our national liberties must supersede our personal liberties at all times.
Mr. Donner?
We are faced today with a campaign of repression against civil rights which is unmatched in our history. This campaign embraces not only persecution of minorities for political opinion, but repression of individuals for their race, and as well as a repression against the labor movement itself.
Well, Mr. Perry, you said they were endangered on every hand. Would you care to expand that?
Well, I should like to say that one of the first major threats to civil liberties today, it seems to me, is the unlawful attacks on life and limb and property. The second area stems from police brutality. The third area has to do with a basic civil right, that of voting. And the fourth area has to do with that of the right to work. Now, I want to say just a brief word about the attacks on life and limb, property. We know that in the past 50 years, there have been approximately 5,000 persons lynched. More recently, we don't have as much information on the fact that in many of our cities, you've had not simply attacks on individuals, but you've had a wholesale burnings, arsons of homes. Out in Chicago, on October the 10th, because a Negro family had moved into what was one time a white neighborhood, a group of vandals stole in for racial reasons, poured kerosene in an apartment building, with the result that 10 women and children were killed and scores were injured. Now, there have been 35 cases of arson in 1946 in Chicago and 25 in 1947. There has not been a single prosecution. Now, this isn't isolated in Chicago. The same general pattern has obtained in Atlanta, Birmingham, Baltimore, on the outskirts of Los Angeles, in Washington, D.C., and more recently we've seen it in newspapers in Walton County. I submit that where you have the flagrant violation of a person's right to live in peace and security, security of life and property, that you've got a real present danger.
Mr. Weber, you mentioned in your opening statement that you felt that name-calling was one of the dangers that threatened our civil rights. Would you expand that, please?
Yes, I wanted to point to the constant practice of labeling every person that you disagree with, labeling him as a communist, as a basic danger to our rights of free press and assembly and speech and worship. I am particularly mindful of this practice because the CIO and the CIO Political Action Committee in particular have been labeled as communist without any grounds whatsoever for that allegation. The constant appeal to passion and prejudice and the disregard of fact, actual facts, and the tendency to boycott and ostracize groups in our life by calling them communist, this, I think, is one of the greatest threats to our basic civil liberties that we have today, particularly the attack on the labor movement found in the Taft-Hartley bill embodies that whole outlook.
Mr. Bailey, you seem to be in some disagreement with that.
Not necessarily in disagreement with it. I like tolerance. I think we have to have tolerance. Tolerance of minorities, certainly. We'll have disagreements as to what the Taft-Hartley bill provides. I don't agree with him that it does take away anybody's personal liberties at all. I spoke of tolerance. I have a lot of it, but I have no tolerance whatever for those who would overthrow our form of government, our form of democracy, to try to find what they call civil liberties under any other form of government whatever. I'm not calling anyone names as to who is or isn't a communist, but I have no tolerance whatever of the Communist Party in this country.
Well, I don't imagine anyone has. Mr. Donner, you mentioned a campaign against our civil rights. Would you expand that, please?
I think that we must recognize that in the repeated and systematic invasion of civil rights which takes place during this period, we see a growing encroachment upon the democratic rights of our people. I'm particularly alarmed at the increasing hysterical practice of equating every form of liberalism with communism. I am increasingly alarmed at the tendency to accuse people without giving them a chance to face their accusers and defend themselves. Let me point specifically to the president's executive order dealing with the loyalty of government workers. Now, the order specifies, among other things, that the files of the Un-American Activities Committee, which contain more than a million names of 2 years ago, be used as one of the principal sources in the investigation of government workers. Now, those files contain the names of millions of decent, respectable people whose sole crime is that they've worked for a better America, that they believe in things like the wage hour law, that they believe in decent labor legislation. Now, not long ago, Chairman Cochran of the House Accounts Committee said this of the Un-American Committee's blacklist. He said, "The records of this committee are valuable records because they contain a tremendous number of names. And how did they get these names? They confiscated mailing lists of so-called subversive organizations they suspected of violating the laws of this country. Undoubtedly, my name is on the list, and so is yours." Now, this loyalty order would use this list as a basis for proceeding against government workers. The order provides that a federal employee be summarily discharged for what the order terms sympathetic association with any group designated by the Attorney General as subversive. Now, here we have brought into our thinking again the vicious doctrine of taint by association, the fact that you can condemn a man because he belongs to an organization you don't like.
Aren't we usually known by the company we keep?
No, in America, we have a tradition, and it's an American tradition, that guilt is personal. We are not condemned for the company we keep. We are condemned for what we ourselves do. In addition to that, Mr. Bailey, we only condemn people for what they do and not for what they think. I have a more basic objection to the loyalty order merely than the fact that it condemns people for the company they keep, which in itself is un-American. I condemn the loyalty order because it condemns organizations for what they think. It condemns groups for what their views may be. Now, it's part of the civil rights tradition of this country that we tolerate opinion, that we don't condemn individuals or groups until their opinion presents, as the Supreme Court has so often said, a clear and present danger to the state. Now, merely because of an organization may entertain views that we may not be in agreement with is no reason for condemning it out of hand.
Well, let me say right there, I want to call attention to the Taft-Hartley bill provisions, which prohibit any labor union from engaging in political activity. It provides that no expenditure can be made by a trade union to publish the voting record of a congressman. It provides that no trade union can hire a hall and express its opinions in regard to candidates for public office. The Taft-Hartley bill denies to the trade union movement the basic civil rights of press, assembly, and speech in regard to political action. Now, that is the kind of danger that I think is current today in American life, the action by state and federal legislatures to deny to organizations their basic political rights.
Mr. Well, Perry?
I want to go back to the question that Mr. Bailey raised, and that is the whole notion of association. I've been very much disturbed about creating orthodoxy among federal employees, because we've found that often, or for the most part, when a government employee is considered friendly with Negroes or with Negroes who are his co-workers, that he's been singled out for investigation by FBI, civil service, and he's been charged with being subversive and everything else. Now, it seems to me that orthodoxy in this country, whether it's among federal employees, whether it's among political thought, whether it's on the basis of color or race or nationality, is something that's bad and represents a very basic threat. And it's been proved not in terms of ideology, but in terms of how the practice has obtained, what's been the result.
Now, you gentlemen seem to appear to be generally in agreement that there is a threat to our civil rights. And where would you say that that threat comes from? From the government or from the leftists or the rightists? Mr. Perry, would you
Well, I would say that there are certain aspects, and I think of many of our state governments particularly, in the area of police brutality. I've already pointed to the fact that there have been 35 cases of arson in Chicago, 1946 and 25 in 1947, and there hasn't been a single arrest. J. Edgar Hoover, when he testified before the President's Committee on Civil Rights last summer, stated that in a particular jail, and I'm quoting him, he says, "It is seldom that a Negro man or woman was incarcerated who was not given a severe beating which started off with a pistol whipping and ended up with a rubber hose." Now, the same thing applies in terms of our federal government. FBI and the Department of Justice have been singularly timorous about enforcing civil rights and civil liberties. The assassination of four people down in Walden County, they interviewed in a small rural section some 2,000 people, and yet they were unable to locate those who lynched and shot and killed four people in broad daylight. I would say one of the threats stems from the fact that you don't have courageous and vigorous prosecution of the violation of civil rights, civil liberties, either by state governments, by municipalities, or by the federal government itself.
Mr. Bailey, do you agree with that?
Well, I think he's making quite a number of rather excessive statements entirely. Of course, he's picking out a few instances and saying that all of our civil liberties are threatened on that basis. I don't condone violence. I don't condone arson. I don't condone lynching, naturally. No one does. But if we're going to give up our generals' democratic liberties into the hands of a federal government and give them power to punish people, to hound people, to surrender our own personal liberties to a powerful federal government, I don't agree with him at all.
Mr. Bailey misses the point, it seems to me. The issue isn't whether we'll surrender our liberties to the federal government. The issue is whether the federal government and the state governments will adhere to their historic responsibilities of protecting the liberties of all our people. Let's not fool ourselves. We're in today a mounting campaign of repression. Let me quote very briefly from a recent letter sent by a large number of faculty members of the Yale University School of Law, lawyers and professors who know their business and who are certainly not given to exaggerated statements. These people say, it is unhappily true that America appears to be embarking on an era similar to that which followed the First World War. There are alarming signs that persecution for opinion, if not soon curbed, may reach a point never hitherto attained even in the darkest periods of our history. With it, we may expect racial, religious, and every other kind of bigotry, which, if it is to run its full course, can loose such a flood of intolerance as utterly to destroy the civil liberties without which no democratic society can survive.
Nice soapbox oratory, of course. What are you going to do about it? You're saying civil liberties are in danger. Now, let's get specific.
I want to come back before we do that to the question of who is responsible for the attack on civil liberties. Now, I cited the case of the Taft-Hartley bill, which destroys the political civil liberties of trade unions.
I don't agree with you at all.
I understand that, but we know who it was that fostered and pushed the passage of the Taft-Hartley bill. It was the Manufacturers Association of America.
I can tell you who brought on the Taft-Hartley bill. That was excessive by others.
And I want to come also to the point that Mr. Perry originally addressed his remarks in regard to the police brutality and general intimidation that exists in the plantation belt in the South, and the fact that 10 million people in the South are unable to vote because of an oppressive poll tax bill, pro-poll tax laws, and the fact that the Fair Employment Practices Committee was destroyed. All of those things stem directly out of the plantation system in the South, big plantations, and the power companies and textile mills in the South continuously fight to keep people disfranchised in the South, to prevent them from voting. You can't cite a single case in the South in which any part of business has been for a Fair Employment Practices Bill or for the repeal of anti-poll tax, for the repeal of poll tax laws, or in which business has fought for the passage of an anti-lynch law. Those three basic things are needed to protect the daily civil liberties of millions of people in the South.
Weber, I just want to footnote what you've said in terms of voting. When the senatorial committee went down in Mississippi to investigate the denial of the franchise to Negroes in 1946 election, numerous public officials of Mississippi testified on oath before the committee that they had consciously made it more difficult for Negroes to vote, that they had persuaded them, encouraged them not to vote, that they had threatened them that if they did vote, there would be violence. That testimony stands before the Senate committee, and yet we have United States laws which can prosecute the culprits in this case. You have not a single prosecution started. Now, the other example that has occurred right in Mississippi is the fact that after the Supreme Court declared that Negroes had a right to vote in Democratic primaries in the South, and they're the only primaries that really mean anything, you had the Democratic Party in Mississippi, which came along and says that as a condition to voting in the Democratic primary, every Democrat must take a pledge that he is opposed to anti-lynch legislation, anti-poll tax legislation, FEPC legislation. And once again, we have the organized apparatus of the state which is subverting basic democratic rights.
But isn't the primary fact, Mr. Perry, this, that in every period of political reaction financed by big business in American life, it is exactly that group that is financing political reaction which is leading the attack on civil liberties? That is to say, the manufacturers, the plantation owners, the power companies, these people are the ones who are pushing the attack on civil rights.
Certainly, that seems to be proved by history, Weber. When we had the repression which followed the last war, the so-called Palmer Red Raids, which most decent people are ashamed of today, that was accompanied by a tremendous attack on the rights of organized labor. That was initiated by powerful employer groups in this country, such as the NAM. The whole open shop movement of the 20s was a counterpart of the repression against the rights of other groups as well as labor, which existed at that time and which we are seeing again today.
Well, now our friend Mr. Bailey here raised the question of what we're going to do about the threat to civil liberties. And I would like to suggest to him that the president's committee report on civil rights is well worth reading. They had on that committee industrialists such as Charles E. Wilson, president of General Electric. And they had prominent and patriotic Americans such as Dr. Frank Graham, president of the University of North Carolina. And unanimously, that committee pointed to a real danger to American civil rights and urged the passage of such bills as an anti-lynching law, a federal anti-poll tax law, a federal fair employment practices law, and they, in addition, urged the outlawing of segregation itself in American life. Now, this was a representative group of American citizens drawn from all walks of life, pointing to what they considered to be a flagrant danger and urging federal action.
Weber, I would like to make this observation that America is made up of minorities, that we have 20 million Catholics, but if we think of them in terms of the total religious groups in this country, they are a minority, 20 million people. Or if we think in terms of Protestant sect as such, whether it's a Baptist, in terms of the total picture, they are minorities. Or if we think in terms of Italians or Germans or English or Irish in relation to 140 million people, they are minorities. Now, I just wonder where we're going to end up if we will permit the violation of the rights of any particular racial or national or religious minority. Are we going to begin at getting to the point where we are going to say that a person who is less than 5 feet tall is obnoxious to us and we have a right to segregate and discriminate?
Oh,
are we going to discriminate
to
against bald-headed men? I mean, we've got to draw a line somewhere, and I submit that as long as any racial or religious or national minority group is segregated and discriminated against with impunity, that no one is safe.
There again, Perry, I think that history bears that out. Liberty is indivisible and repression is contagious. We saw that in the rise of Hitler. Hitler proceeded to repress and oppress one particular group in society, and then he took on another until all effective opposition on the part of minority groups was smashed. And I think today that the repression of any single group, of any single minority group in our society, is a problem which concerns every citizen in this country who's concerned with the survival of liberty. Now, I was interested in Mr. Bailey's failure to answer Mr. Weber's charge that the suppression of the political rights of labor movement was a significant development, because certainly I'm sure the National Grange would be exceedingly concerned if it were prohibited under penalty of a crime from using its funds for political purposes and the funds of its members.
We never used, never have attempted to use, and do not attempt to use political funds for political purposes or anything else. It is nonpartisan. We'd like to see all groups work toward achievement of their aims, but when they work and contribute and try to influence the polls through an organized coercive group, it's an entirely different thing. As members of a democracy, you have the same right that we have, and you have the same right to exercise that right. The Hart-Taft bill does not abrogate that in any sense.
Mr. Bailey, you mean that the National Grange does not give information to your membership on national legislative issues that affect farmers and tell the farmers how congressmen vote on those issues?
We do not attempt to take part in partisan politics. This is a democracy, and one party is just as favored as another party, so far as we're concerned. We talk issues, not politics.
And you mean that the National Grange does not attempt to get the federal government to come to the assistance of farmers when they need that assistance?
We're talking about politics now. Let's don't get off the subject.
And what the national government does has nothing to do with politics, is that right?
Excuse me, if I may interrupt just a second. We have only a few minutes left, and I would like to get onto the specific corrections for some of these violations of civil rights that we've been talking about. Mr. Bailey, I presume we may include you in the group that says that you believe our civil rights are in danger to a certain extent?
Let's make it this way. That people that inhabit this country came to this country to escape certain persecutions abroad. The democracy is founded upon the fact that the individual's right is inviolate. But each individual must give up certain rights to excesses when it is detrimental to the public welfare, as long as we work toward the correction of evils within the form of our democratic government. We should continue to do so. We shouldn't close our eyes to excesses. Naturally, we shouldn't. But there's no place in the world, there's no other country in the world where the minority has the protection that it has in this country today. And we ought to recognize that and not simply wildly scream soapbox oratory against our form of government or the procedures under which we're operating.
Mr. Perry, what would you suggest our doing to correct some of these evils that you've mentioned?
It seems to me that in the overall national problem, we need a much more vigorous enforcement of existing laws. We also need the enactment of anti-lynch law, an anti-poll tax, an FEPC, a Fair Voting Act, a Fair Educational Act. And we need laws not only on the federal level, but we need them on the state and on the municipal level. Now, the average citizen has certain basic responsibilities. He ought to make himself a committee of one to make democracy really work. Every person, obviously, is not going to see a lynching or a burning of a house, arson. But he will see employment discrimination. He will hear a joke, an anti-Negro, an anti-Semitic story here or there. And it seems to me that if he will really want to make himself a committee of one, if he really wants to see democracy work, he will not simply ignore these anti-American activities, but will challenge them.
Mr. Weber.
The first thing we need is that every single individual in America should recognize that every other individual has the basic right to hold whatever political or economic opinions that he chooses to hold. The individual right of conscience must be recognized by every other individual in American life. That's the first thing. And the second thing, we need the extension of national federal power to protect the right of individuals to life by the passage of an anti-lynch bill, and we need the protection, federal protection, of the right to vote by a passage of an anti-poll tax bill. And we need the right of equal opportunity to work to be guaranteed by the passage of a federal FEPC bill. And above all else, we need the repeal of the Taft-Hartley bill to restore to the trade union movement their civil rights in the field of political action.
Mr. Donner.
I think we've got to recognize that we can't create a police state in order to escape a police state, that a danger to our civil rights is just as great whether it comes from a native oppressor or whether it comes from an enemy from without. And in recognizing that, we must all dedicate ourselves to the genuine American tradition of defending and protecting civil rights. We seem to have ignored the fact that this country has a glorious tradition of the pursuit of liberty and of defending and protecting civil rights. We must pass the laws that Mr. Perry and Mr. Weber have mentioned, but we must go beyond that.
I'm sorry I have to interrupt, Mr. Donner. Our time is up, but we do seem to have come to the conclusion that we need the enforcement of existing law and new legislation, both state and federal, the expression of political opinion freely, and the extension of federal power and legislation. Now, Mr. Batchelor.
Printed copies of today's forum can be obtained by writing the Congress of Industrial Organizations, Washington 6, D.C. This has been another in the series of America United programs and was presented today by the Congress of Industrial Organizations. Kennedy Ludlam acted as moderator. Participants in the discussion were Frank Donner, Congress of Industrial Organizations, Palmer Weber, Political Action Committee, Leslie Perry, Legislative Staff, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and Fred Bailey of the National Grange. America United next week will be presented by the Congress of Industrial Organizations and the National Broadcasting Company and its independent affiliated stations. This program originated in the WRC studios in Washington, D.C. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.